things. It is a philosophy, it is also a movement, and it is a set of practices. And the intent behind it is to redirect society's retributive approach to crime and wrongdoing.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. You are listening to Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. The Hawk Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the history of the Hawk Foundation, our numerous grant programs, as well as the many exciting things that we've got in the works, visit our website at www.hogg.utexas.edu. Throughout the education system, there's a growing interest in exploring alternatives to traditional punitive discipline in schools. As a matter of fact, in 2015, the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health launched a relatively small grant program, Trauma-Informed Approaches to Behavior in Schools. And you can learn more about it by visiting our website. It awarded funds to two public schools and one school partnership to support the deployment of evidence-based alternatives to exclusionary discipline models. And a key pivot point in this new movement is the word restorative, as in restorative discipline, restorative justice. And so with us today is Dr. Marilyn Armour, director of the Institute for Restorative Justice and Restorative Dialogue at the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work. And she's going to be sharing her thoughts on restorative discipline and restorative justice and cluing us in to some of what's happening here in Texas to operationalize the new thinking on school discipline. Dr. Armour, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So restorative justice is becoming something of a buzzword. To the point where people may already assume that they have some idea of what it is. And so just for the sake of clarity, what in your mind is truly essential to the concept?
Well, I think it would help to start with a definition of restorative justice, at least conceptually, because it is actually a compilation of things. It is a philosophy, it is also a movement, and it is a set of practices. And the intent behind it is to redirect society's retributive approach to crime and wrongdoing. So what that means, if you deconstruct that, if you take that apart, is that restorative justice is really a victim-centered approach to wrongdoing that gives the people most directly affected by that wrongdoing the opportunity to come together for dialogue and to do what they can to make things as right as possible in the aftermath of that wrongdoing. So instead of asking traditional questions such as what rule was broken, who is responsible, and what should the punishment be, it is a paradigm shift. It's really a mindset shift, which instead asks what happened, who was affected, and what needs to be done to make things right. So it's a very forward-looking kind of a philosophy as compared to a retributive or punitive model, which associates wrongdoing with degree of suffering in the sense of learning a lesson.
Okay, so then let's focus on restorative discipline in schools. Now, does the basic model allow for a variety of approaches? You know, for example, that may emphasize like one dimension of restorative discipline or another.
Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is that in its application to schools, what we are looking at is what we call a whole school relational approach. The intent of restorative practices In this state, it is usually referred to as restorative discipline. Sometimes it's called restorative measures. People like to take the word justice out of it because it does not directly deal with the criminal justice system. Other people might refer to it as school-based restorative justice. But the idea is that you are targeting change in the entire school. You are not just focusing in on the bad kids, because the belief is that the retributive model that we've all been conditioned into is something that shapes how we look at kids' behavior, shapes how we deal with each other, both as students and adults. And so if we are looking to put this into a school, we're really targeting change in the entire school system in a particular campus. So what that means is that we are interested in putting it into classrooms in a preventative kind of way to build community so that that whole classroom begins to develop a whole set of norms about how to be with each other, how to matter to each other, so that if wrongdoing occurs, if there are problems between kids, conflicts between kids, what people use to work those things out has to do with how they matter to each other. So at the classroom level, we're putting it in preventatively. At levels that are often referred to as Tier 2 and Tier 3, which has to do with more challenging or intense situations, we use a variety of restorative interventions. We may do something where we bring a kid who's responsible for harm or conflict together with another student, or perhaps with a teacher. That's often referred to in the jargon as victim-offender conferencing. We may involve family members in terms of two kids, for example, that have had conflict or perhaps a situation where one has been hurtful to the other and caused some level of harm or damage. So it may involve parents coming together. That's often referred to as a family group conference. And we may have situations where we've got a student who has been sent out of the school to an alternative program, to some other situation related to discipline, and is coming back into the school. And so we are looking at what needs to be done to really surround that student with a circle of support and accountability that consists of people who are influential in that student's life, not just teachers. It could include family members, it could include best friends, it could include an older brother, it could include an uncle. But we're looking to surround that student with people who care enough about that student that they're willing to be engaged over some period of time in terms of what that student needs to come back into that school successfully and what that student needs, because in that student's mind, the school is only one little piece of their life. There's a whole lot more of life that goes on that's not lived in the school but can affect how they perform in school. So that's part of why you're broadening the circle, if you will, in terms of all of people who have vested interests in that student. So that's just a few of the approaches that get used in schools.
Okay, so it seems to me that there's at least a tacit assumption that for at least for students who are below a certain age or at a certain level of maturity, that the most straightforward behavior modification is what's appropriate to their level of development, and so that that leads, I think, naturally to those classic forms of discipline that we're all familiar with, and that this new model seeks to render obsolete. To the extent that still is sort of the common sense of the world that we live in when it comes to dealing with kids, how often do you encounter that kind of reasoning still, and what's your response to it?
Well, that kind of reasoning is what we were all conditioned into.
Yeah.
So it is throughout our society, and you see us struggling with it. not just in terms of what's happened with the schools with over-the-top suspensions and expulsions and disproportionality. We see the same thing happening in terms of the criminal justice system. So this is an issue that is at some level on the debate block, let me put it that way, throughout our entire society at this point. But I would say in terms of schools that part of our belief is that this is not a fast fix. This is not something done quickly. In most schools, it's a 3 to 5 year rollout. And the reason that it is a 3 to 5 year rollout and slow is because we're really trying to change that thinking, and you don't do that overnight. It's piece by piece by piece. So among teachers, for example, that frankly in colleges of education get almost no training in classroom management, it's expected that they'll arrive at the classroom able to handle complex behavioral situations because they're good instructors or they have a personal philosophy that's applicable. But beyond that, they're not given any skills. So what we know is that in some ways we're training teachers in for the first time to think differently in terms of how they approach student behavior. So part of what we say is that part of that 3 to 5 years is it takes that long to get the kind of attitude shifts that need to happen. Also, if you're using a relational model, which has to do with who people are to each other, you don't make best friends overnight. It's a slow process. It's an accumulative process where students and teachers are both being changed. So it is very foundational, but we don't expect it to be fast. As a matter of fact, if you put it in too fast, you get a strong reactivity going in response that upends it. Then it looks like the problem is restorative discipline or restorative practices rather than how it's been implemented. One of the other fallacies that people often think is that students have to be at some level of maturity before they can engage in this. Frankly, we have a lot of concern about that because for us that's code for you have to make yourself eligible for it before you get to have it, almost as if you have to earn it. And part of the problem with that is that in the meantime, what do you fall back on? You fall back on exclusionary practices that basically say to students, you're not wanted here. And that's what we have done to students over and over again. We have put it into a KIPP school in this community, K through 3, the youngest children that we have, very successfully in terms of what's happening in those classrooms. There is curriculum that has been written by a gentleman whose name is Tom Cavanaugh out of Colorado in terms of K through 8th grade relative to introducing restorative practices or restorative discipline. So the issue is not so much whether or not a child's mature enough, which puts the weight or the burden on that child. It's more about how we as adults, teachers, administrators, school counselors, social workers, know how to work with kids from a restorative perspective in a way in which we can make it work with them. That's about practice, that's about learning the skills, and that's about doing them over and over and over again.
Okay. So can you summarize the evidence base for, you know, restorative discipline-based approaches?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to cite chapter and verse, you know, the reams of published material that I'm sure that there is, but just to give us a sense of what the evidentiary foundation is.
For restorative discipline specifically.
Yeah.
First of all, I think it's really important to understand that this is a model that has been here for some time. Minnesota's had it about 20 years, and Oakland, which we use as our model, has had it about 10 years. But the research on it is limited simply because you're talking about a very young program that has become very, I don't want to use the word popular, but it is a fast-growing movement because of the issues of disproportionality that have been getting more and more attention throughout the entire country. So people are hungry for something that's going to be effective and therefore have grabbed onto restorative discipline in some ways almost before it's ready. It's been cooked long enough to really be able to be used widely. But we do know, in terms of individual schools and districts that have put it into effect, what some of the results are. So, for example, in Denver, they put it into 7 middle schools. What they found in Denver was a 30% decrease in students for the number of suspensions and a 90% decrease in suspensions and office referrals over 3 years. They put it into West Philadelphia High School, which had been labeled for over 6 years as persistently dangerous school. There they found a drop in the frequency of violent acts and serious incidents by 52%, and the following year by an additional 40%. At Cole Middle School in Oakland, suspensions declined 84% in 2 years and expulsions declined to zero. And at Ed White Middle School, where the Institute for Restorative Justice and Restorative Dialogue put in the first program in Texas, what we saw in the first year was a drop of 87% in out-of-school suspensions and 30% in in-school suspensions. It is very common to hear those figures. As a matter of fact, most recently, there was a publication about Manor MAP, which is the DAEP in the Manor School District, in which the principal reported a 90% drop in suspensions. So that kind of extreme drop is actually commonplace in terms of what you first see when you put it in. What actually is in some ways of more interest are things like, what do you see in absenteeism or tardies? What do you see in school performance? What do you see in changes in school climate? What do you see in terms of teacher retention? Or what do you see in terms of what I call the soft issues, students' abilities to engage in inclusive decision-making, drops in physical conflict, issues about being able to express oneself more fully. So I'll give you some pieces about all of that. There was a comparison of middle schools in Oakland that had put in restorative practices compared to those who did not. And what they found was that absenteeism dropped 24% for the restorative practice schools, but rose 62% for the non-restorative schools. Now, what's important about absenteeism is that it's really a measure of how engaged in the school and in their learning the students are. So if you see less absenteeism, it's a marker that the students are likely more engaged in their learning, which is then going to show up probably in terms of school performance, which in fact it did in Oakland. In Oakland, in the 9th grade, what they found in the restorative justice high schools is that reading levels doubled from an average of 14% to 33%, which was an increase of 128% compared to only an 11% increase in non-restorative justice schools. They also found that graduation rates increased 60% over 3 years in the restorative practice schools compared to only 7% in the non-restorative practice schools. And at Ed White, our Texas school, what we found out was that this was a school that had been dubbed improvement required by Texas Education Agency. Ed White Middle School, when we first put our program in there, had the highest suspensions and expulsions in Bexar County. They scored low on just about everything, and when teachers went there, people would say to them, oh, you know, I basically feel sorry for you. So it was really a hard luck school, if you will. In the second year, when we implemented restorative discipline, the school got 4 stars of distinction in reading, social studies, and math, and scored in the top 25% of most improved, and tied for first place in most improved in middle schools with the same demographics. So what you see there, and that was actually much faster than you usually see it, was a clear manifestation in terms of it being a calmer school, a more engaged school, in which you began to see payoff in terms of what the academic performance was all about. The other thing is that the Santa Rosa schools have found $550,000 savings in average daily attendance monies, meaning if kids don't come to school, the school loses that money. So Santa Rosa schools found that increasing the attendance rates, they actually saved a substantial amount of money. So the other thing I'd just like to comment on is what we're calling, in a sense, the soft skills, because those are easy to forget. Mm-hmm. And yet if you think about where you want students to be at the time they graduate high school in terms of job readiness, you will hear many of these things being what employers are looking for today. So the restorative practices actually help develop these skills just by virtue of being a part of those practices. So what we see is that it builds student character in terms of a moral sense, really, because restorative discipline is built on values, values of respect, values of inclusivity, values of listening, values of empathy. So that all builds more student character, if you will. It fosters an internal sanctioning system where I start doing things differently because I begin to learn what kind of impact what I've done has on other people, rather than just to stay out of trouble or to get some sort of a reward. So that's intrinsic, which is where we want adults to be ultimately. It fosters solving problems together. It fosters understanding and empathy. It fosters listening and reflection, because the questions you ask students as part of restorative practices are things like, what happened? What have you thought about since? How has what happened affected you and others? What have you thought about needs to be done to make it right? Those are all reflection questions, self-reflection and self-accountability questions. It also helps students learn to take turns, learn to, in a sense, appreciate fairness, because in restorative practices, when you work out what kind of an agreement is needed to redress the harm that happened, the student who's responsible for that harm is a part of making the decisions about what's going to happen to him or her. So rather than it being the boom being lowered on me or some sort of a formula that because I did this, here's what's supposed to happen to me, I'm a part of figuring out what makes sense in terms of what's happened, in terms of what the person harmed needs, and what I need in terms of my own learning, or in terms of a way back with the people that no longer trust me, or the people who have negative feelings toward me. So all of that gives me a sense of greater fairness in terms of what's happening to me, rather than my feeling victimed by what's happened. It also helps students to own the responsibility, to learn to make amends, to live with greater integrity, and to live in community, because the students, in terms of what restorative discipline fosters, have a place of belonging in terms of that community and a stake in what happens to that community. There's a lovely story off of Ed White where a teacher was doing a restorative circle in the classroom, and there was a student who was new to the school, who was not from this country, and she started lecturing her peers, her classmates, about what she'd seen in the classroom and about how upset she was with what she'd seen and how they weren't even beginning to realize what kind of opportunity they had. And she just took off scolding them, berating them, to the point that the teacher just sat back and let her do all of the work. But the students were absolutely quiet because of the fact that one of their own was saying truth to them in a way in which they couldn't squirm out of. So you begin to get that level of investment in the classroom, in the community, where students sort of take over the whole thing for themselves. There was another incident at Ed White where there was a person assigned to deal with student-to-student conflict because the students themselves had come up with a process to use when they were having conflict with each other or between themselves and teachers. The process was that they had a page with a big circle on it, and in the middle of the circle, they'd put whoever they had conflict with. They called it the circlet form. And at the bottom of this page, they circled right now, later today, or tomorrow to indicate the urgency that there might be. And the students came up with this themselves. And the idea was that when they were having conflict with each other, they could fill one of these out. It would be picked up by the person responsible for bringing students together. She would pull them from their classrooms and do a restorative dialogue with them. But what was lovely was that it got to the point where the students went to the room where this was done, and they would say to that adult, "We've got it. You can leave here. We're going to handle this ourselves in this room, and we'll let you know when we're done." So that's about students taking it on for themselves.
Wow. So I think we've pretty well covered the evidence base, and thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So is Texas on the leading edge of restorative discipline? And who have been some of the prime movers on this issue around the state?
Well, Texas is very unique in that we were late in the game in terms of putting it into the state. Ed White was the first school that had done it. But because of the success there, there was tremendous publicity given to Ed White. There were three front page stories in the San Antonio Express over a year and a half documenting what was happening at Ed White. There were magazines and professional newsletters that went out to superintendents telling them about it, so that there was a lot of interest in the state in terms of something other than punitive discipline, and a lot of interest because of the concerns about disproportionality. We have very high disproportionality in this state. 76% of all the disciplinaries in schools end up on the shoulders of 76% of them being given to African-American and Latino male students. So that's a civil rights concern. And I think that many superintendents and principals are recognizing that they must do something different. It can't be more of the same. So there's been a huge interest and a huge hunger in terms of people being open to looking at something different. So with that, what happened was that Texas Education Agency came to the Institute for Restorative Justice and Restorative Dialogue and asked if we would develop curriculum in terms of taking what we had done at Ed White to scale in the state. And what we said to Texas Education Agency is that we know that for this to be successful and sustainable, there are two foundation blocks that have to be in all schools. One of them is that the administrative team has to buy into it fully. It can't just be support. It has to be deep engagement, because those are the people at the helm. They're your visionaries. They're your leaders in a school. And the other thing that was needed was that a restorative discipline coordinator needed to be put into each school to help guide the school, to help mentor teachers into the practices, to do some of the practices themselves in terms of more intensive situations, to get student groups, peer groups, going in terms of they're doing their own circles, and on and on. So what we said to Texas Education Agency is we could do training for two-day training for administrative teams, and we could do five-day intensive trainings for restorative discipline coordinators. So Texas Education Agency decided, since Texas is divided into 20 regional service centers, each of which have many districts, so a service center could have 40-plus school districts, that they would select the 10 service education service centers that had the highest disproportionality, and that in those 10, we would go to each one of them and do a two-day administrator training and a five-day coordinator training for up to 25 coordinators. And we would do that in each of the 10 regional service centers. So we have done that. We have done the administrator training now in those 10. We're now in the process of doing the coordinator training in back into those same 10. And the understanding we have with Texas Education Agency is that they will also be funding a round 2 to pick up the other 10 regional service centers, because the ones who got it may have shown greater disproportionality, but the ones that didn't get it have said, we have exactly the same problems. We just don't have a heterogeneous population, so it doesn't look as if we have the problem, but we have exactly the same problems. So the goal is that by fall 2017, all of the regional centers will have been given these two trainings. No other state in the country is doing that. So that has zoomed us ahead in terms of the level of commitment that the state has to putting this in as fully as they can. So we have many eyes in on us in terms of how this is going to work. So that's, I call it a grand experiment, but that's what we're involved with right now.
Okay. So perhaps you could tell us maybe a little bit more about yourself, about your own background and, I guess, personal history of involvement with this issue, and how it is that you have arrived where you are now at the Institute for Restorative Justice and Restorative Dialogue.
Well, let's see. My background is primarily as a psychotherapist. I came to Texas about 15 years ago.
Okay.
After receiving my doctorate. And as a psychotherapist, I did a lot of work with homicide survivors, and I did a lot of family work in which I would bring family members together in terms of sometimes generational conflicts, generational harms that were still being played out today. And I found that when people were prepared well and came together, what they could accomplish with each other was way more than anything I could do as a professional. And so when I found out about restorative justice, which was about bringing together victims and offenders in the aftermath of crime, in terms of dealing with questions that victims had, in terms of offenders having the opportunity to say something to victims about their life story or about what had happened in the crime for themselves or what had happened to them since, that level of engagement did pretty much the same thing as when I was working with those family members, that I watched victims move way far ahead in terms of their healing processes, and I saw offenders turn corners that perhaps they hadn't turned before or wouldn't have turned before unless they knew what effect they had on other people. So that really led me, in coming to Texas, to decide that Texas, which actually had a fair amount of restorative justice going on, but nobody knew of each other. There was no support, if you will, for fledgling programs. So my thought was to create an institute that could do teaching and evaluation and consultation and training. And we could work with places that wanted to introduce restorative programs but needed extra help in designing them, in implementing them, in evaluating them, so that people wouldn't be all alone trying to do something that they didn't know much about how to do. They liked the idea, but they didn't necessarily know how to go from A to Z. So the Institute's been involved with a number of agencies to help them develop and execute those programs. So when Ed White came to the Institute and asked for our help in developing their program, that was within the mission of what the Institute was about. I founded the Institute in 2008. It's a very small institute. We have to be very, very careful about how we use our resources because we have very little and very little infrastructure and very little infrastructure funding. But we feel we've done a lot with what we have at this point.
Well, I've been taken to school. Dr. Marilyn Armour, thanks so much for giving us your time and as well as the benefit of your deep knowledge on this issue. We very much appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me be a guest.